In response to allegations against Harvey Weinstein, women across the country have been sharing their experiences of sexual harassment, also here in Iowa. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we ask what this online campaign represents in the fight against sexual abuse and harassment. Then I'll talk with Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register about how the national anthem Taking a Knee protest has surfaced here in Iowa. Amy Mayer will be along with several bits of ag news. We'll find out what the local news buzz is in Ottumwa. And we'll meet a writer from Iraq, currently in residence here in Iowa. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, in reaction to the sexual abuse allegations against the film mogul Harvey Weinstein, millions of women across the globe have been sharing their experiences of sexual harassment and abuse on social media. Well, we want to find out how that online campaign has prompted Iowa women to share their stories. Katrine Duarte is with me, Assistant Director of Sexual Assault Services with the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. Katrine, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much for having me here.
I understand you've worked with RVAP for 11 years. This must be something different. How do you explain what has happened under the Twitter hashtag MeToo and the rolling post on Facebook?
And the Twitter hashtag is new, but the MeToo campaign has been a 10-year campaign. It was started by Tarana Burke 10 years ago with MySpace. Mm-hmm. And it was recently reclaimed because of the sexual assault allegations. So it's something old that it's coming back.
Okay, thanks for that reminder. But it has really taken on a new life here in the last week or so. What has that meant for you as someone who is a go-to person with services for those who are sexually abused and harassed?
It is twofold, correct? One, it's shedding light on the subject and how prevalent it is in our society. Number two is also having an effect of those that were affected by sexual assault in giving them an opportunity to tell their stories. Yet there is another component that we might forget to talk about, also impact of hearing other stories and someone else's healing. Mm-hmm. And so there's positive, yet there's also some negative effects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about what good that does for someone who has experienced anything from harassment to assault, to know that there are such numbers who have experienced these things as well.
It removes the stigma. It can remove some of the self-blame, and it can remove the feeling that I'm alone in this. And because in our society right now, sexual violence is stigmatized. It's something that you hide. It's something that you deal with it alone. And knowing, oh, my story's is not unique. There's very similar stories all across. So it is not my fault. It's something beyond me, beyond the person that harmed me. It is more systemic.
At your program there, have you been busier because of this with women? How has it impacted your services, or has it at all, the uptick in the talk and the public sharing of these kinds of stories?
It's been impacted with people trying to call more, to learn a little bit more about sexual violence and the impact, because it is a system of power and control, like any of other isms that we see. So it's power plus control plus a tool to take away someone's humanity. The tool in this case, is sex. So sex is used as a tool to rob someone's humanity. But also, we can take the tool and put it with race. Race as a way of robbing someone else's humanity. So it is a system that it is not as simple. It's more complex because it is correlated with other movements of anti-racism, anti-homophobia, because they all share similar components of power control, a tool to rob someone else's humanity.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that this has got a lot of positive aspects, but it also has a downside too, as well. One woman I spoke with, Katrine, talked about, and I'm sure you've heard this side of it too, that all this sharing on social media forced her back to a place she didn't want to go to, in a memory that she had and had her re-experience a bad event. Has that been happening? How do women and others deal with that instance when that negative outcome is here?
In various ways, correct? Because your healing journey and how you deal with trauma is very different for each person. For example, individuals that are being triggered, because you can't escape it in social media. And so you might have to tune out, but you feel guilty by tuning out because you want to support. And so there is those two components. But I...
do you advise in that case?
Give yourself permission to tune out if you need to. But for example, somebody that is being triggered might decide to numb. Because if I numb myself and I put it in a box away, I can do my daily things.
What do you mean by numb?
Numbing might be removing any emotions away. For example, I'm feeling extremely anxious because of I'm reading somebody's story that is very similar to mine, and it brought back that story back up.
Yes.
And I want to put that story away in this box inside me, and I don't want to deal with it. At least right now, because maybe I have a family, maybe I have work, I have things that I need to accomplish, so I don't have time to deal with it right now. So a way of numbing might be purging on Netflix. You see an entire season of a program. Another way of numbing might be an unhealthy way might be drinking. Another way of numbing in an unhealthy way might be using drugs, because it is too hard to feel right now, and I don't want to feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about a quote that was many of our listeners would have heard. It's from yesterday, the White House Chief of Staff, General John Kelly. He was defending the president regarding these calls that the president, any president, makes to those service men and women killed in action. It has nothing to do with this, or it remotely due to is the quote that I wanted to have you react to. He said yesterday, when I was a kid growing up, a lot of things were sacred in our country. Women were sacred, looked upon with great honor. So interpreting that quote, he's seen that the attitude towards women has gone downhill in recent decades, in the recent time. I wonder, because I think a lot of people would share John Kelly's view that women were once sacred and now our society is not holding them in that view. Do you share that view?
No. Look at history. How many women are mentioned? Where are their stories? If they're sacred, their stories would be present. Which women are we talking about? Are we talking about women of color? Are we talking Latinx? Are we talking about white women? Are we talking about socioeconomics? So some women, maybe, but not all women.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How are we doing here in Iowa in preventing sexual assault and protecting victims and working to a better place in our society?
In Iowa, in some instances, in the area of services, we're sometimes a little bit ahead of other states. Mm-hmm. For example, Iowa is one of the few states that has 7 cultural-specific centers that provide services to a specific group. For example, we have LUNA for Latinx survivors. We have NISA for African refugees. We have Monsoon for API survivors. We have Deaf Iowans Against Abuse for the deaf and hard of hearing. We have Meskwaki Family Services. We have Transformative Healing for the LGBTQIA community. We Amani for African American in Waterloo and Cedar Rapids. So we are very unique because services for different communities look different. And so Iowa, it's in ahead of other states recognizing this.
You've named a lot of services that are there to help the victims, which is certainly needed. Mm-hmm. But really, what about the other end, those responsible for the mindset that leads to an assault or an harassment? Is there enough focus on that end of the equation?
That focus is me and you. So what are we doing to stop this? Mm-hmm. So how are you educating yourself? Because we're all part of the same system.
Let's say I'm someone who consumes this news, as many do, but don't feel myself directly connected to the problem that is identified, have my own view on it. What should I do? What can I do if I want to change this climate?
Learn, read, connect, volunteer, be a part of a board member, donate. There's so many things. Join other social justice movements because they're all interconnected. Power, control, tool to rob someone's humanity. Correct? Mm-hmm. So we're all working for a greater systemic change. If you are someone that hasn't experienced any type of oppression or any type of othering, it might be very hard to hear how prevalent it is because unless you are seeing it, is very hard to notice. For some, it's very hard. For example, if you're right-handed, you have some privilege that left-handed people do not have, but you don't wake up every day thinking that I have that privilege. For example, if you go and try to buy scissors, you find it in the same store, in the first store that you walk in.
Right.
For left-handed people, they might have to go to 3 or 4 stores in order to get left-handed scissors or gloves if you play sports. Or just think of shifting in cars. You're picturing your mug. You don't get to see it. And things in that nature that it doesn't come clear until somebody else points it to you. So that is why it's very important to work on ourselves, do our own internal learning, our own internal challenge. And is it not there because it's not happening, or it's not there because I was not exposed? I have a privilege that it's not allowing me to see what's going on.
Katrine Duarte is Assistant Director of Sexual Assault Services at the Rape Victim Advocacy Program at the University of Iowa. It's a sexual assault victim advocate and prevention education society. It hosts the Iowa Sexual Abuse Hotline. I wanted to get this number out here, Katrine. 800-284-7821. It's 24 hours. 800-284-7821. And it also refers services if you can't help us. You can't help the person who is calling at that time, right?
Yes, and we provide services to everyone, not just survivors, victims, or people that were hurt. We also provide services to families, to colleagues, to coworkers, to someone that doesn't know how to support someone that has been hurt or wants to learn a little bit more. So it is because it affects all of us. And so we need to make sure that the support is there for all.
Okay. Katrine Duarte, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me here.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, another national conversation that we've been dealing with the past few weeks, also, of course, occurring here in Iowa among Iowans, the national anthem taking a knee protest at some colleges, high schools even, it's surfacing. Kyle Munson is with us. He's been writing about it for the Des Moines Register, where he's the Iowa columnist. Hi, Kyle.
Oh, hi, Ben.
So let's go through some of the things that you discovered and wrote about in your column. What did you find when you looked out to see how this national anthem protest has been exhibiting itself in our state?
Yeah, I noticed some of the rumblings, as you mentioned, at high schools first. Over in Clear Creek, Amana, there was a football player, an African-American kid on the football team who knelt. And then initially it wasn't really noticed until a week later a racist Snapchat post emerged on social media and spread around and became part of the conversation. There was some coverage. And then in Ames, not only athletes but members of the marching band became part of the protest. They were told that they shouldn't kneel, and so 13 of them ended up leaving the field before the anthem was played, and even more did not perform. But then what really got me involved in writing about it this week, I noticed at Buena Vista University in Storm Lake, there had been both cheerleaders and football players who knelt there during the homecoming game on September 30th. But then the school began to confront this in a really direct way by having a conversation. The new president of the college invited some of the protesters over to his place for dinner. There was a lot of, kind of discussion about what to do. And then they held, earlier this week, they held a forum specifically to address this. They had a few of the students who had knelt on the panel, along with faculty and then a local police chief. And so I was intrigued that here was a public open conversation about this very issue, in the middle of rural Iowa. At the same time, you had the NFL in New York, the players and the team owners discussing the same issue.
Right.
So that's what really got me into writing about it.
And hearing you describe that, Kyle, I'm sure I'm not alone in saying, boy, I wish I had the Buena Vista reaction to it rather than the national reaction to it, where we had, simplified, many of those against the kneeling as a form of protest want to define it as a disrespectful action toward the flag, toward members of our military. Those who protest it say this is not about that. It's about America living up to its promise of equal treatment for all. So it sounds like that must have been a valuable conversation, a valuable way to channel the differences of opinion.
Yeah, I think so. It was more constructive. And it's true, we see this, whether it's on Twitter or just in conversation, it's the debate seems to immediately go to, well, if you're a protester, you're disrespecting, men and women or fallen soldiers, or you're disrespecting the men and women in blue, whatever it might be. And that seems to escalate things unnecessarily. In what I wrote, I sort of point out, and this came out in the discussion at the college too, Colin Kaepernick, who is sort of the font of this particular style of protest, the NFL player, he mentioned that initially he was just sitting on the sidelines, but he began taking a knee because one of his fellow NFL players, who also happens to be a veteran, said, there might be a more respectful way to do this. And kneeling was sort of a way to echo the respect you would show at a fallen soldier's gravesite, for instance. So, some of that nuance gets lost in this whole discussion when immediately it goes to, well, we have to be two tribes set against each other when we're talking about this.
Mm-hmm. In your writing also, Kyle, I thought it was interesting that you start by saying, sometimes I feel like I hear the wry chuckle of history. And you went back to what that relates to what we're experiencing now.
Yeah, it's true. A couple things made me think of that. One was, this was really this latest flurry of activity, all the way to Iowa high schools and football fields, was sparked last month somewhat by President Trump when he lambasted the NFL players in a speech in Alabama, which, I've visited Alabama. I've been through there through Montgomery. And so here we are talking about a protest for, in essence, for civil rights, which Trump was making his comments in a state where we saw, you know, MLK and supporters marching. We saw the Montgomery bus boycotts. So that felt like a little bit of a riot chuckle of history. And then you talk about the national anthem. Well, it was in Iowa and Herbert Hoover. I think you were at the Hoover Museum recently. He signed the anthem into law as our national anthem. So anyway, these little connections made me kind of hear that wry chuckle.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the point you were making here. We've got about 3 minutes or so left, but it's interesting that you tell the Colin Kaepernick story about going from sitting to kneeling as a more respectful form of protest. It made me think. I seem to see it that way too. Kneeling before a grave, kneeling is something that a Catholic in a genuflect will do upon entering, a church. But also, we have a form of protest much more strident. I thought of the 1968 Olympics with the raised fist for Black Power by many of the 1968 Olympic athletes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and. Yeah, exactly. And some of that also happens with this protest, or I mentioned the marching bands walking off the field and not even appearing there, which, you know, I guess if you extend that and you had enough members of the marching band that leave, you wouldn't have an anthem. And so that would be a more disruptive protest. And, you know, there are no easy answers here, and there are a lot of interesting issues of gray around what is effective, what is appropriate. And I've been, as I mentioned this morning on social media, I've been debating with not just readers, but family and friends all this week too. You know, on one hand, this is sort of like the gentlest form of protest because it's not a real disruption. It's not as if they're blocking a freeway, that sort of a thing. And yet it strikes kind of at the heart of what has become a really important ceremony in all of our lives. So there's an open question, even in Storm Lake, at the college in Storm Lake. The discussion ended Monday, and it was very constructive. But some of these students who are protesting now have a decision to face because the president and the administration has hammered out what they consider a compromise, where the students can kneel just prior to the anthem, but they won't be allowed to kneel during the anthem. Everybody should stand and lock arms, and there'll be a show of unity. Well, there's a notion, you know, these students say, you know, protest is really not meant to have a particular time slot, you know, to be effective or to be true to the whole nature of protest. So if these student athletes and cheerleaders continue to kneel during the anthem, they could face, you know, they're open to repercussions, being kicked off the team, whatever it might be. So that's a real question going forward of where they want to take their voice and their social consciousness and, at a private college, they can be disciplined for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Thanks for sharing some of your writing, and as always, thanks for being on our program. Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, Kyle Munson.
Thanks so much, Ben. Always love to be on the show.
All right, then. When we come back after a short break, our own Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media will be along with several bits of ag news, including sunflowers. Wouldn't you like to see more sunflowers as crops in Iowa, at least as someone driving along the interstate? They're beautiful. We'll also find out what's the local news buzz in Ottumwa. And we'll meet a writer from Iraq, and she is currently here in residence in Iowa. We'll hear about her reaction to being in residence in Iowa. Plenty more when this News Buzz edition of River to River continues. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Fridays, we like to have quick conversations about a number of news topics to finish off the week, go into the weekend. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll find out the local news buzz in Ottumwa. We'll also hear at the end of the program from an Iraqi writer She's currently in the a 12-week residency at the International Writing Program that sits at the University of Iowa. The Iraqi writer Lava Omer Darwesh coming up in just a few minutes with some interesting observations about being an Iraqi writer in Iowa, in the United States at this time. But first of all, let's talk with Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk about a few things, interesting things you've been reporting on lately. Fair practice rules. Now, these are some rules that were intended to help some small farmers, but they're not. It's not going to happen.
That's right. The USDA was charged back with the 2008 Farm Bill with writing some new rules that would, the intent was they would give a little bit more authority or autonomy to small farmers, make it a little bit easier for them to lodge complaints against the large meatpacking companies, for the most part, that are buying beef and pork and, to some extent, poultry. There were many acronyms involved. There was a long process involved. But finally, last December in 2016, then Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack released the rules. They were ready to go. They were set to be enforced beginning this week. But Sonny Perdue, the now head of USDA, decided to pull that and not make the change that had finally been put forward.
Mm-hmm. So you've explained the reasoning for making this rule to help the small farmers. Did Sonny Perdue give any reasons why he doesn't want this to happen?
Sonny Perdue and those who have supported his decision seem to feel that if the essentially what would happen is the proposal was like, let a producer say this person treated me unfairly, and they would only have to prove that they were treated unfairly. How the rule had been written originally, and therefore how it will remain, is if a person feels they've been treated unfairly, they have to prove that that treatment hurt the entire industry. And so Sonny Perdue and many of the big agribusiness organizations and companies felt that there was a likelihood this change would lead to frivolous lawsuits and would end up costing everybody money.
Mm-hmm. How do small farmers, small cattle farmers, for instance, feel about this pullback?
They're very disappointed in the decision. They feel that this was a step toward giving them a little more of an opportunity to ensure that they were marketing their beef on an even playing field. It was primarily beef producers who I spoke with, and they feel now they're not getting that attention to this problem that has been identified and was raised many years ago.
You've also been looking into and reporting on this herbicide, and we've talked about it on this program before. Dicamba, I'm pronouncing it correctly. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. Dicamba is something that can, drift into other fields, do some damage? Give us some background here.
That's right. I mean, this is always a concern with aerial applications of herbicide. You're either spraying it on or you're having it dropped on from an airplane, and it's not going to just settle nice straight down from where it was put. If there's a certain amount of wind, it could get blown. That's the process known as drift. And dicamba has been around for a long time, but in recent years there have been a released dicamba-resistant crop seeds. So now farmers could plant these dicamba-resistant crops, apply the dicamba as for a long time they have been applying glyphosate, and you know their crops would survive, the weeds would die. It was a great thing for that field. Unfortunately, the dicamba drifts, and there have been a lot of complaints of crops on adjacent fields being killed by the dicamba. There's even been some concern that trees are being damaged by dicamba drift.
Mm-hmm. And is there a remedy out there?
Well, not really. I mean, not yet. Although the Environmental Protection Agency issued new rules or requirements regarding how dicamba can be used. These are similar to rules that Missouri and a couple of other states were considering on their own. But there is a lot of skepticism that just restricting under what wind conditions it can be applied or that farmers are going to have to fill out forms, you know, documenting how much they've used, that those things are not really going to protect adjacent crops.
Give us an update on the renewable fuel standard under a president who, let's just say he's making coal great again. The renewable fuel standard, something near and dear to the hearts of many in Iowa, and as a renewable source of energy, but also a major industry in the state in the meantime.
That's right. And as a candidate, Donald Trump did come out and say he would support the RFS, but he appointed to head the Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Pruitt, who has some longstanding ties to the oil and gas industry, which is one of the main opponents of the RFS. And there was quite a kerfuffle this week with the EPA putting out some plans for what they thought was going to look like in the near future of the RFS. And many farm state senators, in particular, Joni Ernst and Charles Grassley from here in Iowa, came out and said, whoa, 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 we have the president's word that he's going to abide by the RFS. And last night, Administrator Pruitt sent out a letter reassuring those senators that, in fact, he would abide by the requirements of the RFS and would not make some of the changes that it had been seeming might be on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like at our fuel pumps we're going to be seeing that 10% or even more in some of the things that won't be disappearing from our fuel pumps.
Definitely no disappearance. And one thing that may be more forthcoming is year-round availability of 15% ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
To finish up on a colorful note, you had a nice story about sunflower. As I'm just relishing the idea of having, well, you know, corn is not bad to look at, soybeans not bad to look, but wow, sunflowers, those are awesome. I'm just thinking about my visual delight in this story here. Tell us about the development of that.
I have to say, several years ago, I took a road trip through South Dakota on Labor Day weekend, and those fields of sunflower were just dazzling. And that sort of planted a seed in me to wonder, why don't we grow more sunflower in Iowa? And there's a long, complex history for why we don't. But some of the things that are current are that the way our rotation systems are set up, farmers can make money year after year with corn and soybeans. In hotter, drier climates, that's less the case. And so in places like North Dakota and Kansas, you see more sunflower grown within a rotation that might also include corn and possibly soybeans. Because things have evolved that way, we don't have any sunflower seed crushing facilities here in Iowa. So most Iowa farmers live too far away from one of these plants to be able to reasonably take a harvest to market.
Mm-hmm. Sunflowers, we have just a few seconds left, but sunflowers enjoying a great uptick in popularity, aren't they?
They're doing quite well, and they've been reliably profitable for a lot of the farmers who grow them.
Mm-hmm. And healthy.
So.
I did my research here. Excellent source
healthy
of
oil.
Vitamin E. Copper, vitamin B1, manganese. Don't know what that is. That's a heavy, that's a metal, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess our bodies need
nutrient.
That.
A nutrient, sure.
It's a nutrient. There we
sure.
go. Okay. Excellent. You know, I have some sunflower seeds I'm going to sprinkle on my salad, no joke, for lunch here after the show.
Fantastic.
Okay. Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Thanks so much for catching us up on some of the recent ag news, Amy.
Good to be here, Ben. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, here on News Buzz on River to River, we also like to find out what's happening news-wise in Iowa communities that aren't as often the focus of statewide news attention. Today, we go to the Southeast Iowa community of Ottumwa. Matt Milner is with us, managing editor of the Ottumwa Courier. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. So what's been the news buzz locally there in Ottumwa recently?
You know, the big thing over the past week was the Better Block Project here in town. It brought together folks from all over Iowa, from Main Street communities, to come in, do some planning, some brainstorming, and ultimately creation of kind of an idealized downtown block. They had pop-up businesses, they set up specialized bike lanes, a temporary park, and they even capped it off with a performance, live music in the old theater, which originally was the Opera House downtown, and it's the first time in, I believe, 75 years that we've had live performances in that building.
Mm-hmm. So it's a revitalization of the core of Ottumwa, and residents really feel like they would love to have what aspects specifically made better.
You know, the thing that people really seemed to get the biggest kick out of was the pop-up bagel store, of all things.
Pop-up bagel store?
It was a pop-up bagel store. It was open for the 3 days, and it sold out almost immediately every day. The goal was to try and get people thinking not just about what Ottumwa could have in terms of downtown businesses, but what they'd like to have and how to get there.
Mm.
And so to get everybody thinking and really having the opportunity to see, okay, you know, this is what it could be if we put in the effort.
Mm, that must have caused some excitement. What else is going on in Ottumwa?
The Wapello County Foundation made $175,000 in grants for the current cycle, and one of the big ones went to Seton Catholic School for rebuilding their playground. The school is a landlocked facility. They can't really expand too much, and the current playground's on a bit of a slope. And so anytime you're talking about working in an enclosed area, you know the price goes up. So they're going to be able to take this money. It's going to help them out with flattening the new playground, get that ready, make it a little bit safer and a little bit nicer for the kids. So that's a program. The school's a big part of the community, both the private school and the public schools, and Seton's going to benefit nicely from it.
Great news. What else has been going on in Ottumwa?
Well, to the public schools, they've had kind of a wild couple of weeks. A sinkhole emerged. They did a major renovation at Schaefer Stadium over the past summer. And then with the rains a couple of weeks ago, a few days after that, they're looking, wait a minute, what's this? And a small sinkhole, it appears to have been an issue with the drainage from the old field, dating back quite a ways. Mm. So they've had to repair that. And then a soccer ball, of all things, hit a sprinkler in the gymnasium. And that's never good news. The sprinkler goes off. They had to deal with that. But there are also discussions about the use of student activities funds for adult clothing here in Ottumwa, looking at whether the money is being spent appropriately. We've submitted several FOIA requests asking for information, asking for some records, and we don't think that story is anywhere near finished.
Okay, it's something to follow there. Matt Milner, you said the sinkhole, you know, a state we normally connect with sinkholes is Florida, for instance, not Iowa. This sinkhole didn't swallow anything, did it? A house or anything?
It did not swallow it, and it was off of the football field, right on the sideline for what would be the soccer layout. So it was not a major problem. Everything's still under warranty. They're working on it, and it's more of a you-got-to-be-kidding-me moment than a real emergency.
Matt Milner, nice to talk with you. Managing editor at the Ottumwa Courier. Talk to you again, Matt. Thanks.
Thank you.
And finally today, on this News Buzz edition, the end of a series. Since the end of August, 35 riders from 34 countries have made a temporary home in Iowa City. It's part of a 12-week writer's residency. It's amazing that since its founding in 1967, over 1,400 writers from more than 150 countries have come to Iowa to enjoy this residency at the International Writing Program, part of the University of Iowa. Well, back in August, just days after they'd arrived, this latest batch, I attended a welcoming party for them and talked briefly with about a half dozen of the writers. Today, the final writer I spoke with, who's from Iraq.
So my name is Lava Omer Dervish. I'm 24 years old. I'm from Iraq, mainly from the Kurdistan region in Iraq. I live in a beautiful city that's called Suleimania City. So I mainly write in English. I'm a poet. Mostly the genre that I'm writing is poetry. I'm also translating works, poetry and prose from English to Kurdish and vice versa. So, like I've mentioned, I'm writing mostly poetry, but I'm trying also with other genres, such as some journalistic styles, some short stories, and I would like to start off with my very first novel soon.
Okay. So can you describe some of the themes you like to touch on with your poetry or your other writing?
Okay. So in my poetry, I would like to touch upon some of the very important issues that is facing us in Iraq, if it's not only in Iraq or other places in Iraq. For example, I wrote a poem about Dua. So Dua is the very first poem that got published through the Lantern of Hope and Iowa Review. So it was about a Yazidi girl that was stoned to death by her family and parents around the places. And I also write about issues such as some of the political issues or some of the corruption that is going on in Iraq. So I mainly go through the... you can see the themes or the issues that we have in Iraq and try to discuss it through a different perspective rather than the usual one that everyone is seeing.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, I don't want to put you on your spot. You're on a nice in a nice gathering. You look beautiful tonight.
Thank you so much.
And do you have any of your poetry that we could hear in your native tongue? In Kurdish. You're a Kurd, I think,
yes,
right?
Yes, I'm a Kurd, but I mostly write in English.
Okay, well then in English, just to get an idea of what you do. I don't know if you have anything.
I can remember a verse or two.
Yeah, please.
So, yeah.
And what is this one about that you're going to have a couple verses from?
Yeah, Dua. Dua is the poem that got published in Lantern of Hope and also in Iowa Review. I can remember lines in the middle. Okay. Stones rain on me. Stones show love to me. All I see is stone. Enough stone to build a citadel. Stone after stone made me numb. Stone after stone, I felt how much I was loved. Stone, it was love that made them lose control. And oh, they even hurt me back from the other zone. So that's all that I can remember.
Mm-hmm. And so this is something that we've been addressing here in the United States with immigrants and so forth, honor killings. So you're
yes.
addressing that, honor
yeah.
killings where yeah. a family yes. may actually kill a daughter.
Because she loved a guy that was a Muslim and she was a Yazidi. So in the Yazidi culture, it's forbidden to love or to marry someone who's not a Yazidi.
Mm-hmm. And does this actually happen? Do you know of people this has happened to?
So the Dua case was very common. I think it happened about 10 years ago. It was all over the TV and the media. It actually happened more than once. But like Dua case was more common. It also... years ago, there was also, I mean, you can see it through the news. You have the honor killing issues all over again, at least once in a month, with different issues, different cases, different kind of a weapon, whether it's beating you up, whether it's through stabbing the person or using guns.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, so you've been in Iowa 2 days?
Yes.
And is this your first time in the U.S.?
Yes, it's my very first time in the U.S., and I'm so excited to be here.
Okay, tell me, specifically, you'll be with more than 30 other writers here at
yeah.
the residency of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
What excites you most about being with writers from around the world?
So, yeah, it's very exciting to be around people from different cultures, different backgrounds, different way of thinking, different way of writing, and let me say, different age range. So I'm 24, I think I'm the youngest in the group. So we have people in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s. So each one is thinking in their own way. Each one is bringing a different culture. They can be a sort of inspiration to you. Yes.
Do you have specific writing goals while you're here?
I would like to have my very own first collection of poetry. I have lots of poems, but like I have not thought about, you know, connecting all of them and make a collection. Other than that, I would like to write as much poems. I would like to give a try to some of short stories. You know, I have all these ideas, but I've never given it a try to write them down. Maybe I would like to start some playwrights, maybe. Yeah.
We have a beautiful evening here in Iowa next to a nice lake on the outskirts of Iowa City. What is your first impression of Iowa and Iowans?
Well, the people here are really, really nice. It's similar back in Iraq. So you can ask people for help. They can help you out. They are so friendly with you. They are so complimentary, if we can say so. So it's similar to the people back at home. And the place and the surrounding is very beautiful. It's the opposite of Iraq, as I can say. You have the beautiful river. You have the forest. You have all this green area. And the place is so quiet. That makes you feel with peace with yourself, in peace with yourself.
All right. Well, yeah. Lava Omer Darwesh, if I got that halfway right.
Yeah, you're right.
A Kurdish writer from Iraq. Welcome to Iowa, and thank you for telling us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you so much, and hope to see you soon.
Well, that was the last of my conversations recorded a few weeks back, getting to know a few of the 35 writers from 34 countries who've come to Iowa for the International Writing Program's Fall Residency. Well, if you'd like to hear more conversations with this year's resident writers from all around the world, simply go to iowapublicradio.org and find River to River. That does it for this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Just a program note, Monday during this hour, our sleep doctor, Dr. Eric Dykin of the University of Iowa, will be back. He'll answer your sleep-related questions. You can email those sleep-related questions now to our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. He'll also comment on the latest in what I'll call the snooze news. This is from just a few days ago. A Kentucky boy falling asleep for 11 days straight, a medical mystery
that is baffling doctors. We'll ask our own neurologist, Dr. Eric Dykin, about that. Well, let's leave you with this music as part of this week's Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City. Many interesting events, including musical performances in the Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City this weekend, including this band tonight, Beach Fossils. They're from Brooklyn. This is one of their tunes called Sugar. They'll be performing tonight at Gabe's in Iowa City. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy this bit of music by Beach Fossils.